of chapter 4 and spent most of our time basically with the thought there in verse 1 that same mind. And it says, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves. We should also arm ourselves with the same mind. Be willing to suffer in the flesh for him. Because he goes on to say, for he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. If we have chosen, if we have made the choice to follow Christ, we have made a decision to cease from sin, to not live in sin. And I want us to just go on and follow the thought here down into verse 2. When we cease from sin, what does that mean? In verse 2, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lust of men. If we're living, we're in the flesh. But obviously that's not the physical. That's flesh in contrast to spirit. We should be living in the spirit, in the mind of Christ, seeking. And it says, not for the lust of men, but for the will of God. Again, that contrast. And he goes on to say here in verse 3, it says, we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. Now, people talk about in young people, particularly young men, you know, the ideas, I'm going to go sow my wild oats and then I'll settle down. You don't hear that expression anymore because most of them don't settle down. But and it's not just young men. But the point here is whatever time we have spent in these things, it's enough. More than enough. And I want us to briefly just look at these that are mentioned here. These are not words that we often use, some of them. For example, lewdness. And the idea of lewdness is absence of restraint or indecency. There are those things, and we're taught that, for example, when someone attacks us, how should we respond? Should we respond by coming back at them with the same? No. And we restrain ourselves. There are times that someone is explaining something to you in great detail, and you know they're telling you all about it, and you're like, well, not only are you wrong, but everything you did tell me, I already knew. And so, do you let them have it? Do you smirk? Do you grin? Well, no, you restrain yourself. And if you laugh, it's inside. Obviously, those are little things. But what we're talking about here is typically things that are immoral. In 2 Peter chapter 2, this same word is used in describing. And we're going to begin actually in verse 4 to get the whole context. It talks about here, it says, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, now if God didn't spare angels, what's the point? Will he spare men? No. If God didn't spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. Now this was on a daily basis. This wasn't just the particular time that we have a record of. But the filthy conduct. What do you think of when you think of filthy conduct? And particularly these, and it was all the men from the oldest to the youngest, came to the door of Lot's house and to say, bring these men who have come into you, bring them out, that maybe we may have sex with them. When you say no, that's what it means. Adam knew his wife and she had a son. Adam knew his wife again and she had another son. He knew her. And you understand. And their filthy conduct. And it's interesting. And I think it is something to notice. That when the angel struck them blind, they still continued trying to find the way to get into his house. You would think that would be enough. In Jude, a reference to the same event, if you will, the same time. In Jude, and we're going to look just at verse 7. This is the destruction of the wicked. It says, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them in a similar fashion to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Things that ought not to be done, they were doing. That's what lewdness is. And I have kind of grouped these into groupings, going back to 1 Peter 4. Lewdness and lust. And lust is inordinate desire, uncontrolled desire. When we think of lust, we usually think of sexual. And that is certainly lust. That is probably the thing that most people are more guilty of when we think of lust. But lust is any desire that is beyond, that you can't control again. And look, if you will, into Numbers chapter 11. This is the occasion when the people cried out to Moses and asked Moses, you know, we are so tired of this manna. Now, can you imagine? They had manna to eat. And they had manna for lunch. They had manna for breakfast. They had manna for supper, if they had three meals. How many different ways can you prepare manna? I don't know. But there does come an end. And as they're there and they're tired of this, they groan and they complain. We had fish. We had this. We had that. We had all these things. How would you have done with manna? I'm afraid today we're a little away. Bit spoiled. And it's interesting that it says here that Moses heard them crying at the entrance of their tents. They didn't come out, but they were there. And you remember that God sent them quail and they ate. Verse 32 looking says, and the people stayed up all that day, all night, and all the next day and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 omers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp to dry out. But while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against this people. And the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. Why? And continue reading. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. Yielded to their lust, if you will. Was their lust for sexual? No. On this occasion, it was for something that was okay, food. But it became something that they could not handle. And that's what lust is. Now, when we come back to 1 Peter, again, we're going to look at some things, and some of them are very pretty clear. Do I have to explain drunkenness? No. We all know what drunkenness is. The New King James says drinking parties. What is drinking parties? And the old commentary said, this is parties in which the main purpose is drinking. I don't guess they called them cocktail parties back then. But again, when you have a cocktail party, what is it? What's there? Well, there are some hors d'oeuvres. There are snacks. But what is it that this is all about? It's all about drinking. And this is classified with drunkenness. This is classified with orgies. Is this something that's minor? No, obviously not. The revelries, the orgies, the wild parties. Orgies, I don't think I need to define. I think you all know more than you want to know. But revelries, what's the idea? And if you've ever seen Mardi Gras, you've seen revelry. When men and women are walking down the street dressed in a fashion they shouldn't be, everything's about drinking, everything's about partying, everything's about everything that you could do according to their tradition before Lent, where you had to give up everything. And it has only gotten worse. It has only gotten more and more. In the islands, every island has their carnival, as they call it. And don't think of rides and those kinds of things. It's not that kind of carnival. It's a carnival with parades. And 5 and 6 year olds are dressed or undressed and parade. There's the children's parade. Then there's the adults' parade. And it's bands. It's drink. It's sex in the street. Well, they're clothed, typically. But you can imagine. Well, or unclothed, whatever. But I mean, the point is, that's what it's all about. And it's funny because the radio announcer in St. Croix, you know, he'd find a new word from time to time, and that was all he used for a while. When carnival time came, it was the revelers, the revelry. And I thought to myself, true words have not been spoken. Wild parties. And this is those that are totally out of control. And I mean, you know, this is one of those things, and TV used to, at least anyway, there was the joke about the man at the company Christmas party running around with a lampshade on his head because he was that drunk. But that's the kind of parties that we're talking about. The time passed. If we've been engaged in those things, we've done it enough. That's the things that we should not do. But it does go on to talk about here abominable idolatries and all of the kinds of things that were involved with that then. But I want us to notice also in verse 4, it talks about in regard to these things, they, your friends, your companions, who you used to do these things with, they think it's strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. And I think particularly with people who have been in the world, this is one of the hardest things, is when their friends begin to talk about them, and sometimes they even know what it's going to be, what will my friends think about this? Well, they'll think you're crazy. Why? Why would you do this? How did you, what made you change? And he goes on to say, they will speak evil of you. As Matthew talked about in the class this morning, and it's interesting, the last two Sundays, there's been kind of this overlap. One of the things that is imperative, if a new Christian is going to continue to be a Christian, they're going to have to make 5 social changes. And what that means is they're going to have to change 5 friends. Now, does that mean, that may mean in some people's case that they have to give up 5 friends because they're going to lead them away. because they're the ones that are saying, "Are you crazy? I can't believe you did this. What bewitched you?" But it also can mean that you need to make 5 new friends. And I think that is, at least from what I've seen, what we've seen, that is one of the keys. If a new Christian does not make new friends that are Christians, if they're just kind of on the edge, it's going to be very difficult for them to continue. And we, knowing that, need to help them. We need to take them in because it is there. And in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus talks about how far this may have to go. In Matthew chapter 10, beginning there at verse 34. Jesus tells us, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be those of his own household." Why? Because some are going to become Christians, some are not. That is going to be a problem. If you are a Jew and you left Judaism, and this is true among the Orthodox Jews to this day, "I have no son. I have no daughter." If they leave Judaism, that would be division. And that's what Jesus is saying here. But he goes on to say, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me." Now, Luke's account says he who hates, who does not hate father or mother. But I think the idea there even is of loves less. Where do we put our parents? Are our parents, our children, our spouse, our whoever, our boss, what place do they have? If they're keeping us from serving God, we have to love them less. We have to put God first. It doesn't matter who these people are. We need to make those changes. And so I want us to think now and go back to 1 Peter. But now we're going to go to chapter 1. Because here we're really dealing with growth and becoming and growing as a Christian. And I want us to read, beginning there at verse 13. Peter says here, "Therefore, because you've been redeemed, therefore gird up the loins of your mind." And gird the loins, think of when they were going to run, they had a belt, a girdle that they would use to bring their robe up, to get it out of the way. And that's what he says, "Gird up the loins of your mind, be ready, prepare yourself, be sober, rest your hope," notice the word hope, "fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lust as in your ignorance," what we just talked about, "but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Because it is written, 'Be holy,'" God speaking, "for I am holy. And if you call on the Father, who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear, knowing that you are not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. He indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you, who through him," through Jesus, "believe in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope is in God." Now, brethren, this is what we're talking about here. As he who called you is holy, you also be holy. Not conforming, verse 14, yourselves to the former lust. lust, as in your ignorance. But I want you to notice that this paragraph begins and ends. Where is our hope as Christians? Our hope is in God. If you were to go to the doctor and he tells you, and think about this from a worldly standpoint, and the doctor tells you, you have this cancer and it's 50-50. Now we're going to do surgery and we should be able to remove it, and then we'll do radiation and chemo and all this. And where would your hope be? And again, don't think of this from a, it would be God for us. But otherwise, where would your hope be? It would be in the surgeon. It would be in the doctors. It would be in all the things that they're going to do. Where is our hope? It's in God. In verse 21, so that your faith and hope are in God. Our hope in this world is in God. Our hope does not depend on whether this country gets its stuff together. If our country continues down this path and goes down to the bottom, to the gutter, our hope is still in God. And I'm not saying we shouldn't teach, we shouldn't talk, we shouldn't live so that people can see and change and turn to God. But our hope is in God. It's not in prosperity. It's in God. And we need to remember that every day. What is it that's important to us? And there in verse 13, rest your hope fully on what? Upon the grace. And it's interesting here. We understand, we know that we're saved by grace, that our hope is in grace. But notice when that grace is going to be brought to us at the revelation of Jesus Christ. I mean, that's going to be the time, if you will, that we're going to see that grace. When we're standing before Him, thinking perhaps of the sins, my grace is sufficient for you. Our hope is based on that. And it goes on to say, brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ when He comes again. In the next four verses, He talks about, what does it mean you left these things behind? As Matthew also said in his class this morning, you know, you put these things aside, but are you just going to not do anything? No. You need to be doing something else. And it shouldn't be changing one vice for another. It should be filling our life with good things. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lust. But if He who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Because God says, I'm holy, you're my children, you must be holy also. What is holiness? And it isn't sitting around all the time, you know, thinking good thoughts. It's much more than that. God is holy. What makes Him holy? His righteousness, His justice, His separation from sin. That's what we need to be imitating. That's what the things we need to be thinking about. What is righteous? What is just? What is loving? Love your neighbor as yourself. And He goes on to make the point that I'm afraid many Christians, if they ever knew, have forgotten. And if you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work. You know, if there are third, fourth, fifth, sixth generation Christians, and there's a real danger there, because some of these people, as we like to, Dana and I like to say, they're Church of Christ. They're not really Christians. They're Church of Christ. Do they know the traditions? Do they know? Do they miss a service? Maybe not. But they do it, and the way they live is because that's the way I was raised. Ask them why we don't use instrumental music. They may or may not know the answer. Ask them why God hates divorce. Or does God hate divorce? They don't know. And he warns the brethren here, you need to remember, the fact that you've been baptized, that's great. But it's not just to begin, it's to continue. And he makes it clear here that God judges according to each one's work. And because of that, we need to conduct ourselves throughout the time of our stay here in fear, in awe, in respect. Not just I'm God's child, that's good enough. And he goes on to talk about knowing that you are not redeemed with gold or silver or things of that nature. You can't buy it. But rather, he says, with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. And he mentions here these traditions. And he says, from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers. Where did the Gentiles get their wicked lifestyle? From their parents and their grandparents and so on and so forth. Where did the Jews get the law? Again, from their parents and the traditions. But he said that these traditions are aimless. We have been redeemed not with the things of this world, but with the blood of Christ. And he goes on to make the point here in verse 20 that he was foreordained from before the foundation of the world. Now you and I make plans a month out, and we may have to change them. You know, we make plans for tomorrow, and we may have to change them. But this is a plan that was made from before the foundation of the world. It was foreordained. It was planned that Jesus would come and die on the cross. And why does he mention this here? And I think the point is that through him, through Jesus, we believe in God. Why? One of the reasons is because he foreordained this and it came to pass. And so he goes on to say, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and your hope are in God. Brothers, sisters, if Jesus was killed, was raised from the dead, never to die again, was glorified, is now sitting on the right hand of God, and he's our elder brother, what is our hope? Where is our hope? It's in God. It's the only permanent thing. We can hope that we have good health, and we probably will to some point. We can hope that we have enough to live on, and in this country we probably will. But all those things are going to cease at some point. But our hope in God will not. And so we have to remember that's what it's all about. And so I ask you, what stage are you at? Are you that little seedling that's just starting, that's okay. But we don't plant seedlings to see those two little leaves. We plant seedlings to see the beautiful plant that it will be. It will become. And so what stage are you at? Have you died to worldly lust? And we're surrounded with it. It's everywhere. On the internet, it's anonymous. Things that most of us wouldn't even think of are there. And that's not a good thing. There is good on the internet. But whatever it is, the time past is enough for those things. Have you turned away from worldly friends? And again, I think this is a very important point. A young man, well, he's not as young as he was, but he went to college at Tribeca. And he chose Tribeca because it was a religious college. And, you know, the first semester, it was just so refreshing because he'd come out of a public high school. And, you know, people there are religious. People talk about God. The atmosphere is so much better, and so on and so forth. But by the end of the second semester, he realized, these people are really not helping me. Were they worldly? No, that wasn't the problem, although I'm sure some of them were. But he realized, these people are not encouraging me in the truth. They're encouraging me in religious error. How tragic. He realized it. Many don't. And again, these aren't worldly in the sense that we think of. And yet, they are. And finally, is your hope fixed in God? Because that's what it's all about. If your hope's not in God, you're not going to.